Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome, everyone, to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio. And I like to say Persistence Radio, Apropos of Something, airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we have a show all about heart. Dr. Angela Taylor is here. She directs the Cardiometabolic Network, a multidisciplinary clinic at the University of Virginia. We'll discuss her research revealing fascinating information about how to prevent the diseases you may be predisposed to, including the diet that will help, and much more. And we are very honored to have Alexis Mason here, an educator and parent who works to bring equity in education and improve access to resources for the most marginalized students, usually students of color, who for systemic reasons often lack the tools they need to excel in and out of school. We'll see just what's needed and her inspiring work showing us what can be done. And Nancy, speaking of inspiring, are you there, my friend?
Inspiring. Yes. Who's not going to say I'm here for that? Yeah, I'm totally here. I'm here. I love the heart thing, Ellen. That's quite a metaphor. I'm going to sully it right now and say that the man in the individual one is one guilty individual. He has, I don't know, a black heart, a cold heart, a treasonous heart, a felonious.
Not new information. But it is the first time that prosecutors, and they're from the Southern District of New York, not a federal government, I believe, on this, are alleging he committed a felony.
There's two campaign finance misdeeds, criminal activities with silencing those affairs, influencing the election. Yes.
Campaign election fraud.
That we know of.
Yeah, that we know of.
It's going to be the office pool.
There was a SEAL document, too, that has a lot of stuff that we know nothing about, I believe.
It's going to be a story problem in algebra. If the president, if the former president has committed two felonies going eastbound on a train moving X miles an hour, and make it like Air Force One will be his, like, white Bronco or something. Anyway, it's going to be an amazing story problem we'll get out of the deal.
Yes. It's been an amazing few weeks, years, whatever. Speaking of hot air, may I say, I was prepping for the show this morning, as always, and I heard, this is what I heard. Don't want to whistle into the mic, but it was this air, and I knew immediately what it was. I went outside, and it was the most magnificent hot air balloon, just like right above my house. And I took a lot of pictures. It was so cool.
That is cool. Was it like a person, or was it like, you know, was it a commercial thing, or was it just like a blue balloon? Or
you're less familiar in New York City, but here we have these things flying around a lot. I mean, not every day, but they're here a lot. So can we get back to Mueller for a second?
We need to get back to him. I'm so glad you pivoted. Yes.
It's actually to the administration. We hear very little about Mike Pence, but the Borowitz report, a humor column, said that Pence asked Jesus to rapture him up before Mueller can indict him. There was like a little fake news story. I just thought that was really funny.
It's all a matter of how many days will he be installed before he gets convicted of something as well, right? I mean,
I know.
I hope. I'm talking to myself. Just hoping.
As they say on this.
Because you know who's third? Yeah. I'm sorry. You know who's third?
Who's third?
I believe it's Nancy Pelosi at that point.
Yes.
I
think so.
Would that just be?
Yes, Speaker. Madam President.
Yeah, right? I think. Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry.
I don't know what I was going to say. Just never mind. But I was going to say that. I was going to say, as the Stephanie Miller Show likes to say all the time, a syndicated show on this network, on this radio station that is hilarious every morning at 9, the guys, they always say that Pence is up to his albino eyebrows in this. Yeah.
Yeah, it's gonna be a lot of late night mayonnaise binging for him until this all shakes out.
I have to say, my mom's texting me right now. We're going to get right to the show after this. She's texting me saying, so, Mom, if you're listening, she's hearing background noise. I think you've got something else turned on the background of your own computer, is my thought, because I think everything's going fine here. So for anyone tuning in,
tell your mother my audio on my computer is off. Everything's off.
So I want to get right to
maybe
our
it's the
next...
hot air balloon.
I know. Let's get right to our next guest.
Okay.
Not to stamp on all your comedic talents. So welcome to the show. Don't speak yet because I have this really good introduction for you. So as I mentioned, our first guest is Angela Taylor. She's a doctor. She directs the Cardiometabolic Network at the University of Virginia's Medical Center. The clinic brings together a multidisciplinary team to help patients heal from serious cardiovascular ailments and other problems. Angela's research in the Dominican Republic and at UVA reveals fascinating information about how our bodies work and how to best care for our hearts and for our overall health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yes. So I know you've done studies with people with very progressed heart disease who are very sick, and you've got some interesting results. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. That's probably a really good segue into this. So I work with patients who have mainly cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and obesity, all of which are current ailments that we've seen a super big rise in. So we have a clinic where we treat those, obviously, with medications and lots of other things. But the first group of patients that we really started to focus with only dietary modification was in a group of patients who had failed all medications. So despite statin drugs, which treat cholesterol, every diabetes medication we had, they were still very out of control. And so we decided to do something radically different, and we decided to make them vegan. Now, I don't really like to use the word vegan. I don't mind being vegan because I've never been quite normal. But I think for a lot of people, that scares them a bit. So we tend to stick to a whole food, plant-based diet instead of calling it vegan. Because honestly, you can be a bad vegan. You can eat Oreos and potato chips all day if you want to.
Mm, good point.
So we took this group of patients, and they all agreed for a month to go on a vegan diet. Now, some of these were local people that were turkey farmers. Some of them ate meat every single day of their life, but they really didn't have a choice. They were going to either die or try something radical. So they did. They all agreed to try something radical. There were about 15 of them. All 15 of them, I'm proud to say, made it through it and did not die from trying some radical diet. And they did great. So during that study, we measured several things. We measured their blood sugar levels, their blood pressure levels, and we also measured a measure of inflammation called hsCRP. And that basically tells me what your artery walls look like. Are they inflamed? Are they upset? How are they doing? Are you likely to have a heart attack? And everyone in that study had marked improvements in blood sugar. Many of them came off of all their medications for diabetes. Blood pressure improved, and markers of inflammation plummeted in just a month. So all of those things have the ability over time to markedly change your risk of dying from heart disease, diabetes, or manifestations of obesity.
You know, the skeptic in me, Angela, wonders if, well, this didn't involve pharmaceutical drugs of any kind. Are you going to be able, you know, your lab, your clinic, are you going to be able to, like, spread this healthy lifestyle versus, you know, getting money because you're, you know, pushing pharmaceuticals instead?
So, you know, that's a great point. And I'll tell you, in this country, that's hard, right? Because no one wants to support a dietary modification trial. All the money's in pharmaceuticals. Government funding from the NIH has gone down. So a lot of our funding does now come from pharmaceutical companies. But interestingly, I've had a lot more success in other countries, not in the United States, but in other countries, because I think patients in the United States, too, have gotten used to an easy fix of pills. And working to get to the same outcome isn't as exciting, as enticing, or quite frankly, as fun. So in the Dominican Republic, we've done exactly this. So, and believe it or not, this trial was sponsored by Edwards Pharmaceutical Company. They also make devices for the heart, like heart valves. And so they have a plant in the Dominican Republic, and they were actually interested in helping the population to become more healthy. Now, they also do a lot of trials down there with heart valves and things like that, as well. So they certainly still make a lot of money there, but they were very willing to support this trial. So we went down there actually with no medications, and we tried to recreate what we have here in my clinic, which is a super high-cost clinic in this country because lots of medicines, lots of people. We went to the Dominican Republic. I took my team down there. We had no medications, and we essentially took 10 members of the community that people looked up to and saw as leaders. And we trained them with very simple mechanisms to help a group of people to work with diet and to work with exercise. And we gave each of them 10 people per group. And they met with them. They had to meet with them at least monthly. We followed them for a year. At 6 months, this is mainly a diabetes trial and a blood pressure trial. So we checked their blood sugar and their blood pressure every month, but we returned at 6 months and at 1 year to do formal testing. So at 6 months, much like this country, everyone improved. In this country, at 1 year, even with a medication trial, everyone starts to drift back to where they came from in terms of blood pressure and blood sugar measurements. In the Dominican Republic, they got even better.
Wow.
Simple lifestyle changes.
So why do you think that? What's the difference that you see culturally?
I think culturally in the Dominican Republic, if you tell someone they have diabetes, they think it's a death sentence. And if the next words out of your mouth are, I can help you change this and you have control over this, it changes their whole attitude as to how they approach the disease. And they're willing to do a lot more there than we are here because they don't have the easy fix of a pill.
Mm-hmm. Is that why the U.S. numbers some of the numbers went back to the original because they didn't continue what you had taught them or what, you know,
the lifestyle piece of things. And that's true for even really, really big diabetes trials in this country. The lifestyle piece of things tends to trend off at about 6 months and people slowly drift back to baseline.
How are you able, because I know you are teaching and running a clinic, how were you able to do both, you know, be in two places? Essentially,
well, I have the most tremendous staff on earth in my clinic, and they essentially run my clinic because I'm often in the cardiac catheterization lab doing procedures. So I have a phenomenal staff of nurse practitioners and nutritionists and diabetes educators and pharmacists that honestly really do most of running my clinic now. So it gives me freedom.
So
were you able? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Ellen.
I was just going to say, we were just talking about the cultural differences between a country like the Dominican Republic and here. But you had some great examples. I know we discussed about the changes that you've seen here when people went on the vegan diet. There's a couple stories that really stood out. Can you tell us some of that?
You mean the turkey farm?
Yeah.
So there were a couple patients that really stood out in our initial vegan trial. And again, these were people who were really going to die if they didn't do something drastic. So we had a turkey farmer who came in for the vegan diet, and he decided to do it. I never thought he would succeed. He went for a month and didn't eat a turkey or any other kind of animal products. And at the end of that month, he came in, he sat down in front of me, he goes, I'm a turkey farmer, and I'm never going to eat a turkey again in my life. So he had just had such tremendous success. He felt so much better. He had so much more energy. He came off of his diabetes medications. So that was just remarkable.
And he said, this is what you told me, you saved my marriage, you saved my life.
So that was another patient, actually, who came in, and he was about to get divorced, severely overweight, felt terrible, and he came in as a last-ditch effort to try the vegan diet. And at the end of a month, that's exactly what he said to me. I feel great, I've lost weight, my diabetes is controlled, and you saved my marriage.
Amazing.
Marriage counselor and lab. Extraordinaire.
Well, you know, the diet does it all. We've seen such marked improvements in depression, anxiety, just with changes in diet. I mean, an animal-based diet is very inflammatory, and it's inflammatory to more than just your arteries or to things that cause your blood sugar to go up, but also to your psyche.
Mm-hmm.
How much is, if there's an average, but how much do people spend trying to, you know, after having with diabetes, how much medical bills do people accumulate with, you know, trying to cure diabetes after versus preventative, you know, doing what you're describing, these diets? How much do we spend on healthcare?
Diabetes alone is a billion-dollar industry, right? And for someone like me, I would love to decrease the cost of that. But for drug companies out there, they don't mind the cost of that, right? They're making tons of money from this. And a lot of the food companies and drug companies aren't so separable. And so food companies produce basically your food from the second it's born in the ground to the second it goes in your mouth. So they determine who grows it, where it's grown, how it gets processed, how it gets to you. Does it travel 5,000 miles to get to you, or is it next door? And then they process it and they sell it to you, and they make money off of that. And very interestingly, they're also happy to take advantage of your obesity then, because the majority of companies like Weight Watchers, SlimFast, Jenny Craig, were bought by food companies. So they're very happy to make you obese, blame you for it, and then give you the solution, as long as you'll pay for it.
Incredible.
It's amazing how political. I mean, the minute you started that answer, it was like all I kept thinking about was just everything is, I know this isn't brains, you know, this isn't rocket science, but everything is so political, you know, it's just amazing. Speaking of that, how did you arrive at the Dominican Republic for your, I think it's your the first place you brought this mindset to? It might not be, but that's the only one I know of. So how did you arrive there?
Yeah, that's the first country we've looked at outside of the United States. And I ended up there because we originally started going to the Dominican Republic to treat rheumatic fever. So rheumatic fever causes problems with one of your heart valves that weaken, as interventional cardiologists, balloon back open. It gets tight and we balloon it back open and can make people feel a lot better. So that's how we ended up in the Dominican Republic initially, basically training them how to do different procedures in the cath lab. And then following that, became very interested in what surprised me a bit was the obesity and diabetes epidemic in a third world country. Which I think, again, comes back to the same food company issue that we were talking about earlier. And when there's a glut of food, it has to go somewhere. So we're very happy to send that food to other countries, whether they need it or not, whether it's good for them or not, whether it puts their local farmers out of business or not. As long as it's profitable to our food companies, we're happy to do that. So we really have started to create an obesity epidemic in third world countries by sending them food.
Goodness. What I was curious that Americans arrived in the Dominican Republic to tell them, I know you bring such good news, but was there any pushback because you weren't local doing this when you started this endeavor?
You know, it's really interesting because anytime a physician shows up from the United States of America, they are so happy and so thankful, and they will plow each other over just to get to you. So it was a warm welcome, much warmer than I ever imagined it would be. And then when you start talking to a population that eats all carbohydrates, drinks a lot of alcohol, smokes a lot of cigarettes, and you try to change their lifestyle, I was very surprised about how much resistance we didn't get. But again, I think we were giving them control over essentially death that they never had before, because they had no idea that they could not get diabetes.
So this is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're going to go to a quick break and come right back with Angela Taylor. She's the doctor and the director of the Cardiometabolic Network at the University of Virginia's Medical Center. When we come back, we're going to talk about what is a better predictor of health, disease, genes, or lifestyle. And then maybe a little bit about her own story and her family's story. I think it's going to be quite remarkable. We will be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're going to talk in a few minutes with Alexis Mason, educator, community member, and parent here about equity and access. And right now, we're speaking with Dr. Angela Taylor. So, Angela, so we were talking over the break with Alexis, too. Something that popped up was, how would you combat the issue that we were talking about before, that people don't really want to stay on the plan?
Well, I think that really depends on what resources you have, right? So if you have all the money in the world to buy anything in the world, it comes down to a matter of laziness, probably, and just not wanting to change your lifestyle, right? But if you don't have access, that's a whole nother story. Because if you walk out of your door, you look around at every single place you could go and buy food, the cheapest place is obviously probably going to be the fast food restaurant down the street. So McDonald's, Burger King. I know McDonald's is having Burger King is having a promotion soon where you can buy a Whopper for a cent if you're in 500 feet of a McDonald's, right? So it's cheap food. And I think in an area like Charlottesville, we're pretty lucky here because we have a lot of local agriculture. And I think the more that people can be involved in community-sponsored agriculture or buy from local farms, which can be quite affordable. It's not like going to Whole Foods. You can buy vegetables that are good for you and not expensive. When we did this vegan diet, we actually went to every single grocery store in Charlottesville, including Food Lion, and we replicated the vegan diet in every single grocery store. So it is doable on a low income. But I really encourage people to get back to local producers because that's what's going to fix this problem in the long run when we start supporting our local producers. And in a lot of cases, that is very affordable. That's not possible everywhere. It's becoming more possible in New York City, too. There are CSAs in New York City, a lot of rooftop gardens. You can grow gardens even in your own backyard in New York City, as you can here. So I think we just have to change our mindset about where our food comes from.
Are you getting any, I don't know how people contact you, but our countries rather, but knowing that you've done this work in the Dominican Republic, has that sparked any other countries, or are you more easily getting other countries to, you know, listen to you when you want to reach out? Is it a stepping stone?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I have so many offers that I have to turn a lot of them down. We're getting ready to go to Zambia to start a cath lab with one of our other physicians at the university, and we'll be implementing the same lifestyle programs there as we've done in the Dominican Republic and in this country.
So will you come and talk about that when you come back?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So I did want to also bring up what I mentioned before the break about what's a better predictor of health and disease. Is it your genes or is it your lifestyle?
So, you know, that's what I hear from a lot of my patients. I can't do anything about this because it's from my mom's genes or my dad's genes, and it's not my fault. Well, that's true for some genes, but not a lot of genes. So if you have something like diabetes or obesity or coronary disease, there's something that we call multigeneic, meaning that there are lots of different genes that contribute to them. And when you have a process like that, about 20% of whether or not you get that disease is the fault of your genes. 80% of it you can control with your lifestyle, because what we've learned over time is that we have an amazing ability to modify what our genes do by the environment that we give them. So I think that's super encouraging for disease processes like diabetes and heart disease.
Speaking of heart disease, I know this is totally your world. I read that of your specialties is women's heart disease, and I was wondering, what have you found that is specific to women?
Yeah, so interestingly, we started a clinic within the last year focusing on something called fibromuscular dysplasia, which is an abnormality of the lining of the arteries. And it turns out that those women can get spontaneous dissections or separations of their artery wall in their head arteries and their heart arteries, causing things like stroke and heart attacks. And it's very different from standard cholesterol buildup that we think of. In fact, they don't have any buildup of cholesterol in their artery wall. So it's a very different process. It's one that's not understood well and something we're really focusing on in my area of research, as well as a lot of other people around the nation.
So speaking of DNA testing, which
yes,
we weren't, but we were speaking about genes, tell us a little bit about what you think about doing one of those kind of tests like 23andMe or whatnot, and then maybe how your own experience was with that.
Well, I did it, and I think you have to give it a lot of thought before you do it. So going into this, I thought, well, I'm going to know from my genes everything I'm predisposed to. So that means ovarian cancer, breast cancer, Parkinson's disease, coronary disease, diabetes, all of that. So I think you have to wonder, what am I going to do when I know that? Is it going to freak me out? You know, am I going to be frozen? Am I not going to be able to go on with my life? Or am I just going to change my life to affect the things I can? And if I'm going to get Parkinson's disease, I'll just retire early and have fun, right? So for me, it was the latter. I wanted to know because I think it would have really markedly changed how I live my life. So I got my genes tested. My biggest risks were coronary disease, diabetes, and obesity. No surprise if you look at any of my family. And so I went vegan about 6 years ago, really just to reduce my risk.
And you are trim. You can't see it on the radio. She is extremely trim. You look like one of the people that just can just eat whatever you want.
Well, I can because it's all vegan. You can eat houses when you're vegan. It's amazing. The calorie content is lower. There's a lot of fiber. I mean, it's a wonderful diet. And I never restrict myself from eating when I'm hungry, ever.
And I do have to see that when I'm doing that, that you kind of want what you are eating. So little by little, after you get into it for a while, whatever the change is, you start to kind of crave those healthier foods if that's what you're eating. So if you're eating a lot of sugar, you're craving sugar or meat for that matter. And I've just found that you kind of want that stuff. And then you can get creative. I don't know. I'm just having a really good time eating mostly vegan myself and really, really enjoying it. And I really consider myself, as Nancy knows, like a real, not an arrogant foodie, but like I love food so much.
I love food too. I love to cook. And I can't tell you the amazing door that was open when I did become vegan, because there were so many things I'd never eaten in my life that are just amazing. And it was a radical change. It was hard to start with. Believe me, coffee was terrible until I found a creamer that I liked. And now milk tastes rotten to me. It's a taste change. And you do learn to crave the healthier things. And you really don't care much about meat or sugar or any of those things.
Angela, I know you mentioned when you took that test, there's a family history of some of that. So being that you're part of a family of some size, how... Have you convinced anyone to follow this, path that you're on, the nutritional part of it?
So that's a very interesting question. So when I first became vegan, my family thought I had lost every brain cell in my head. They were super concerned about Christmas because they had no idea what they were going to feed me, how they were going to feed me. I just became this alien for a while. And I think my mom was sort of watching all this, right, because she's the cook of the family. And for a while, she would get interested. She'd ask me some questions here or there. And then about a year, maybe 2 years after I became vegan, out of the blue, my mother calls me on the phone and she says, I've gone vegan. And I almost passed out. I really almost passed out. My mother at that point weighed almost 200 pounds. She now weighs 134 pounds. She exercises routinely and she has for the most part maintained her vegan diet. And she's a lot healthier for it and a lot happier.
That's amazing. That's an amazing call, or however she contacted you. That's amazing. Congratulations.
So I think a lot of times it's just letting people watch you and not trying to pound them too much over the head, although sometimes you would like to.
Yeah, good reminder for me. So also, I was really interested personally in what you were saying about the liver. I mean, this may be in the weeds, but just tell us a little bit about what you know.
Well, so there are a lot of interesting things about the liver. For a lot of time, the most common cause of liver failure has been alcohol, need for liver transplantation. Now the most common cause of liver failure and liver transplantation is obesity. So we tend to store things in our liver when we don't need them, like sugar and fat. And if we store enough fat in the liver, eventually it becomes very dysfunctional, it gets fibrotic, and it dies. And then you have to replace it. So we know a lot about that process now. We know that it's almost completely reversible with diet if you find it early enough. So definitely it's not the end of the world. It's fixable. It's just a matter of treating it. We also know a lot, too. It's funny what you learn about the body and what it does that you never knew. So we know a lot about the gut now, too. So it's full of bacteria. And it turns out that those bacteria have the ability to digest your food in different ways depending on what you eat. So meat eaters have bacteria that make a chemical called TMA. We'll just call it that for short. It's trimethylamine, big long word. And that chemical in the liver gets oxidized and it gets converted into something called TMAO. And so we know now that if you eat meat, carnitine, or sources of choline like eggs or milk, it gets converted into this chemical, which helps cholesterol to build up to go directly into your artery wall. So it contributes directly to buildup of disease in the arteries. If you're vegan, your bacteria cannot make that chemical. So we've learned a lot about what your body does in response to what you put into it, particularly the liver.
Why did you become interested in healthcare, if I may ask?
Well, I actually started out in surgery. I like adrenaline. I was going to be a trauma surgeon, and I ended up being an interventional cardiologist, which has plenty of adrenaline when people come in dying of heart attacks and you're trying to get arteries open and they're having all sorts of bad heart rhythms and crazy stuff is going on. I love adrenaline. And the more I walked into a cath lab and the more stents I put in people's arteries, the more cholesterol I squished up against the artery with the stent, I thought there has to be a better way because this is just a Band-Aid.
Go ahead. Yeah, please.
I mean, I barely breathed, Nancy. You knew I was going to ask a question.
I could.
Well, all I was going to say was that's just phenomenal because how many doctors are doing that and don't really think about another way?
Well, I think, you know, medicine, like the food industry, is a lot about economics. And I think a lot of it, you have to change your mindset.
Oh, and actually, one more, like maybe more, but the clinic you set up in the Dominican Republic, how does one take advantage of it down there? How complicated or free is what I'm getting? Is it free? Is what I'm getting at?
So it is. It's mostly run by a grant, and the community members that are working in it are donating their time. I would like eventually to be able to pay them so that we also contribute to the economy of the country in that regard as well. But they donate their time and they have a great interest in improving their community. And it's not only an improvement in health, but people start spending more time together. And one of the things that they commented on, we haven't measured this yet, we'd certainly like to, is that there's a marked decrease in crime as well because people are now talking to each other, spending time together, and actually caring about each other.
That is so cool. I got to say, I'm sorry, Ellen. I know you're going to say something.
No, I was just going to say, we're going to have to wrap it up, unfortunately. It was really fun talking to you. So interesting and so important.
Thanks awesome.
For
Thank
being
you.
Here. That's Dr. Angela Taylor, Director of the Cardiometabolic Network at the University of Virginia's Medical Center. Do come back.
I will.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Nance, do you have
she
a news?
She made my heart feel better. I probably owe her some money for this visit.
And you're going to go vegan now, right?
She truly, yeah, that too. It's very heart healthy.
It's
a heart healthy, anyway. Go
As
ahead,
I Ellen. Mentioned, the show is all about heart, which we're going to find out very soon when we talk to Alexis Mason as well. Do you have a news of note, Nance?
I do. It takes place not in the Dominican Republic. It takes place in Wisconsin. The GOP holding their but one public hearing last week before dismantling democracy in the middle of the night. They passed a series of laws to ensure that their will would override the will of their constituents in five breathtaking ways. I will run through them very quickly. The first being that they're cutting early voting from 6 weeks to two, even though the court told them that was unconstitutional. They're trying it again. They're stripping powers from the governor and the attorney general. The attorney general who had promised that he was going to take Wisconsin off of the lawsuit to kill Obamacare, they're now going to prevent him from doing that. And the governor also promised that he was going to undo strict voting laws. He is going to be hamstrung about that. They're forcing him to enact the Governor Walker's plan to make it harder for people to qualify for Medicaid by making all this red tape about work requirements. And lastly, they're going to spread out all their elections so that it makes the voter turnout less and try to ensure that they keep their state Supreme Court majority. I'm done.
I know there's something like that going on in Michigan and, of course, the North Carolina
yes.
election, the real
yes.
election
that one's
fraud that's going on is just horrific. And it's amazing that they're looking into that at all. And I'm thrilled about it, the North Carolina piece. Anyway, mine is just, but it's a report from CIRAC, who's been on this show, Priscilla Mendenhall. She runs an immigrant coalition. So it's good news, and it's also a little bit of a call to action as the end of the year giving is approaching us, we're in it now. So there's a Seville resident they're calling Eduardo, who was arrested for driving without a license on Route 20. And then upon completing his sentence, he was detained by ICE, and then because staff at the Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail made a courtesy call to notify them of his release. So he was taken to the Farmville Detention Center, then moved to Texas. His bond was set at $10,000. His family was deprived of his income. His two-year-old refused to eat. His attorney had to represent him by phone. So CIRAC members were able to bond Eduardo out, and they created the Seville Immigrant Bond Fund. So he's now back at home. He's back at work. His son's eating. He can meet with his attorney in person. And his next immigration hearing is set for 2019. So this is happening 20 to 40 people in Charlottesville annually are arrested for these kind of minor crimes, and then they are placed directly into the deportation pipeline. So what you can do is just give to that bond fund if you are so inclined, and that is civilimmigrantbond.org, I believe. Or just Google CIRAC, C-I-R-A-C.
Sure.
Until December 31st, your donations would be matched up to $5,000 thanks to Westminster Presbyterian Church.
It's tragic, and it's amazing. People are just amazing, you know. They make it so hard.
Onto much happier topics. We have Alexis Mason here. She is an educator, community member, and parent. She is also what I am calling a social entrepreneur with a deep commitment and dedication to marginalized youth who she sees struggling to get equal access to education and to community resources. She brings practicality, sharp intellect, and heart to her work as a gifted resource teacher in the school system. She's the founder or co-founder of multiple organizations, including eSTEAM for Girls. Welcome to the show, Alexis Mason.
Morning.
Good morning. So tell us about, I know you were, I have to say, very modest when I spoke to you before the show in prep, you know, using those terms, which are amazing, educator, community member, parent. But you're also a social entrepreneur, and you do quite a lot. So tell us what you see the problem is with equity and access for youth, and who is most affected.
Well, I think initially, even just through my own upbringing, and I think I remember telling you about my mom, you know, who was a single parent, and, you know, she was a community organizer. But I tell you, I didn't lack for anything. You know, she was able to tap into many community resources. She was able to advocate for us as her children. And we participated in just a wide range of activities. And I just want the same thing for every child in our community. So I do see the problem twofold. One, as an educator, I do feel like there are some institutional barriers that we are grappling with, but we need to be even more intentional in how we make sure that there is equal access and there are opportunities for all of our students, particularly students of color, students who are economically disadvantaged. And then the other issue, I think, is really parent and community engagement. We've got to wrap our heads around how we make sure parents have the information they need and the resources they need to fully engage in their children's success.
And, well, speaking of parents, how have you found you get their attention? How can they help with advocating for kids?
Well, in my 24 years of teaching and being a mom, I really think word of mouth has served me well and served the families that I work with well. It does help that I am a teacher, but I will say that there are, in our community, just phenomenal community organizations that also work with families one-on-one and kind of chart that pathway for them and helping them connect to resources, even down to how I work with parents in terms of answering their questions very directly, getting them in touch with the right people on the school side and in the community, passing along resources when I find them. Sometimes I'm doing the Google searches and, you know, hounding the internet so that I can find resources, and I share them broadly with many groups and organizations that work with families and children. And I do think that that's the starting point, is that we have to, we won't ever have just one clearinghouse to find these resources, but we do have to make sure that we're sharing it and that we're working together to make sure we're reaching all families.
We're talking with Alexis Mason. We're going to come right back after this break. Stay with us. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Of course, you're listening to Apropos of Something. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So, Alexis, before that interruption, we were just talking about access. So can you continue with that thought?
Sure. I just feel like, and I know from teaching that we have a real divide, not just in our Charlottesville Albemarle community, but in the nation in terms of our students of color and our economically disadvantaged families and the level of access they have, even, you know, from the time that their children are infants. You know, it's interesting that you started with healthcare, you know, but it's the same conversation. You know, you have these institutions that have been built, you know, by those in power, and those in power don't give it up easily, nor do they share the stage in terms of engaging stakeholders in the same balanced way that I think may lead to some real educational reform and lead to, you know, achievement growth in students. So I just feel like that the issue of access can't be underestimated, you know, when you're talking about equity, when you're talking about opportunity for students. And, you know, that's what I'm most passionate about.
So can you give us some examples of what you see?
Sure. What I see, at least from the standpoint of the work that I've even done with eSTEAM, and one of the reasons why the four other women and I started eSTEAM for youth, is that enrichment opportunities cost. I grew up in a very thriving metropolitan area as a child where there were many free opportunities or low cost. And we do have some of those in our community. But by and large, you're talking about activities that are very cost prohibitive for families, especially those that are related to engineering, science, math, and even the day camps sometimes prohibit parents from paying for, you know, the full range of opportunities for their children, whether it's a hands-on workshop, whether it's a theater camp. I find those things to be very limiting for parents of color. And so we've had a lot of outreach from the community, and one thing that we did when we started eSTEAM was to make sure that the event was free. And we provided a range for grades 5 through 8, and then opportunities for high school students to volunteer. And to me, that is one of the biggest costs in our community, is that the opportunities are so cost prohibitive that it doesn't meet the needs of students. And then the other issue is just, you know, we're a fairly rural community. So the distance to travel matters as well. And we don't have a hub, you know, once you get outside of the city of Charlottesville, where you can convene to have multiple events running throughout the summer. Many schools do a fantastic job in surrounding counties of offering even day camp opportunities and things like that, and using the school site as a place to hold those. But some of those even cost.
Did you find, Alexis, when you were creating eSTEAM for Youth, that it was, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so how was it finding people in the community, leaders in the community, to get involved and maybe even expand what the potential of those workshops were?
Easy as writing a letter and making a phone call. I will tell you, we have been pleased at the interest shown by businesses and other community organizations to partner. We didn't establish eSTEAM to create anything new. We really wanted to make sure we had space for other community organizations and businesses who had something to offer our youth to be able to come together. And we kind of manage the logistics of it, but they do provide and facilitate the sessions for the students who participate. And I think that is just wonderful. And we're finding that more and more is that our business community wants to learn and wants to grow their capacity in being able to help and being able to address, you know, the needs that we have for academic enrichment in multiple areas. So eSTEAM stands for entrepreneurship, science, technology, engineering, the arts, and mathematics.
And did you get, what was, and aside from the community, what was the reaction, you know, from kids? Was it, did it fill up right away, you know, or you?
Well, the first year we actually had to, we had a waiting list, and so we serviced about 200 students and had a waiting list of another almost 100 students. This year, about 250, and again, a waiting list of about 75 to 100. And we keep getting requests for content-specific enrichment opportunities. Health and medical has been a biggie. We had a group of young men who volunteered with us this year, and they definitely said, well, whenever you all are ready, we're ready to have an e-steam for boys. You know, so I do think that traction is there, you know, for this type of event, particularly because we have so many different disciplines and career exploration opportunities within e-steam that students and families really felt that they had a wide range of interests covered, you know, in the day-long workshop.
How do you also get other resources, or how do you connect with parents? Because you mentioned that that's a stumbling block.
Yes, you know, two of the members of e-steam are educators, and the other three members have children. And I think that matters because we just kind of put our parent hats on, and we just filtered those our inquiries to people we know. And so a few of us belong to different email lists and groups that we were able to get the information out. We sent it to all the public schools, even in surrounding counties. And actually, we had quite a bit of interest from Nelson and Fluvanna through the event, and parents just told each other about the event.
And those, the e-steam, you know, the entrepreneurship, science, technology, engineering, art, and math, those were chosen for a reason. Please, why did you choose those as the focus?
We chose that as a focus because those areas, one, because those are the main areas that are covered, you know, through most students' education in some class or elective that they take. But also, we're listening to the business community. You know, we have a lot of infusion of people with different perspectives and in different jobs and in different career industries, and they are telling us it's never too early to start. You know, the kids are telling us. So we're really getting feedback from students who are interested in things, but they may not know what the job entails or what types of activities will lead to further interest or further skill building in a particular area. And so I feel like we're hearing from many different areas in our community about what kids need and what kids would like to explore. And I think that makes a difference when you're talking about how do you forward that to their high school years and then the things that they become interested in as careers when they get older.
I want to talk a little bit about the gifted, you're a gifted resource teacher. You know, there's a lot of conversations about children of color are maybe tracked or not tracked into the right place. Can you just talk about your role and what you're seeing that's going on in schools?
Well, I am excited nationally and even locally. I think we are addressing and realizing that we have so much talent and so many students that are underrepresented and underserved, particularly in gifted ed and programs for high ability and gifted learners. And it's undeniable that the institutional barriers rooted in racism that really affected, you know, how kids are identified, how kids are perceived as learners, what strengths and talents are deemed appropriate or in wealth for certain groups of students in certain environments where we look for talent. You know, are we looking at, you know, our most vulnerable populations as much as we're dealing with students who have quite a bit of access and enriched home lives? I think all of that matters when we're having that conversation. But I am pleased to say that we are having the conversation in very deep ways. And a lot of that involves personal reflection. Much of the identification, you know, does center around school communities, what that gifted review committee looks like, who that gifted resource teacher is, what environment that teacher had been trained, what are the look fors when we're talking about identifying students. And I think a broader view of giftedness and talent development is taking hold.
And what are some of the ways, I mean, that sounds amazing. So I'm curious, how are kids responding, or what are ways that you are approaching them that is working?
I think for me and my role, and every school division is tackling this in different ways, for me and my role at my school, yes, I have an identified caseload, but I also make myself available to be a resource to all students, all staff members, all of my colleagues in the building. So I do feel like I get to be introduced to just such a wide range of students and their talents, and they ask me just about anything, and I feel like if I'm able to find the answer for them, even if I don't have it myself, then I'm serving them. You know, sometimes it is making sure that they have some academic support if they need it. Sometimes it's advocating for them with counselors and teachers about appropriate placement in classes and the challenge that they might need to put to make sure that they have the rigor they need to be college ready or to be ready for some certification course or what have you. Sometimes it's connecting them with a community member that might offer them a job shadowing experience or a mentorship opportunity or an internship opportunity. I feel like that makes the difference for a lot of those families. And other times it does involve some serious coaching with parents where I may help them craft letters so that they understand what language that they need, to use with their teachers and with the counselors and with administration, and making available the forms and the process for identification fairly easy to find for them. Mm-hmm. And that's based on how parents have come to me with their questions about the process that they feel like they have experienced with their children.
And tell us about some of those examples where you've been able to see this in work, in action.
Oh, one child in particular, I will tell you, he was identified in another school division and came to the one I work in now. And I heard from teachers and heard from other people in the building who worked with this child and just felt like he was just difficult to work with and that there just seemed to be a wall up. I saw the opposite. I saw a child who felt like he was bored in class, felt like he had been challenged, but felt like he had no choice but to be in the classes that he was in. And it really just took talking with him about mindset, mm-hmm. talking with him about advocating for himself in the classroom, talking with his teachers in very specific ways about his strengths. And a lot of times we approach conversations about student achievement in terms of, you know, a child's deficits. And we're not always talking about the strengths they bring to the classroom, and not just academic strengths. I think that there are some social strengths and there are some intellectual abilities that we don't ever get to really hone in on when we focus just on the grade. And many teachers, you know, do such a good job talking about how students are doing well. I just feel like I'm trying to give them an opportunity to do that in as much, you know, as there may be a problem like there was with this particular child where, you know, there were some roadblocks. There was some challenging behavior, but they were for very specific reasons. I was like, okay, I think I'd be a little frustrated too if I if I felt like I could do more and had not been given the opportunity to do more. So sometimes it is working with teachers on ways to reach children on a personal level, as well as providing them the rigor they need in the classroom. And then other conversations have to be had with those who schedule, our counseling staffs who schedule students for classes and work with families during the registration process, particularly in the high school level. I think that matters. And I think the point is, even, you know, when we heard Dr. Taylor earlier, you can't do this without the community. And I've already mentioned four or five different groups of people, even just within the school community, that have to be involved. But if these conversations are happening without parents who also have goals for their children, who also can tell you their children's strengths, and they're never invited to that conversation or invited, but they're still on the margins of the decision making, you know, I think that there are opportunities to make that conversation more inclusive. And in order to do that, I really feel like you have to engage parents early on, and you have to keep them engaged. And it does take some creativity because parents aren't always available. Parents work very, very hard. And, you know, I do feel like we are starting, and I'm seeing it, you know, I have nieces and nephews in other school divisions in other states, and I hear nuggets of what they're saying, too. I feel like these are conversations that many communities are having right now.
Good.
Yeah, it's great that you've detailed just that idea that getting out of one's mindset, like it's all about grades or it's too late or it's just set up and you're stuck. I mean, everything you just said is why it's perfect that you're a gifted teacher person, you know, resources person.
So if there's one other point we either didn't get to or you want to elaborate on, what would that be before we have to say goodbye?
Parents have a lot of power and they should use it. I really feel like parents have to be relentless in what they need for their children. And if parents feel like they don't have a voice and don't know where to go to find the information, mm-hmm. don't stop. keep asking the questions, keep pushing, because they deserve that information. They deserve to be stakeholders in every single conversation around their child's development.
Thank you so much for being here, Alexis Mason. Yeah. Both of you, please come back. Alexis, it was just a joy to see you in this.
Thanks.
I've seen you in other aspects of my life, and this has been wonderful. So yeah. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And such important work. I really was moved, I'll just say.
And it wasn't a school day. So that's how committed Alexis is to this.
Yeah.
Just want to say.
All right. Well, I was going to get all sappy and just say how moving it has been to talk to you about these things and how dedicated you are. And thank you for doing this work.
There are many of us out there.
Yes. Yes. As she modestly always points out. But yes, it takes a village. So, Nance, do you have a palate cleanser for? I need some music, right? I need to. Let me prompt it. There we go. What do you got?
Okay, in lieu of raking the world's forest, I have found that there's an online business called brandless.com that makes tree-free Kleenex and toilet paper, for that matter. It's bio-based, made from sugar cane and bamboo grass, no dyes, no fragrance, 2 packs of Kleenex, 6 rolls of 2-ply, $3. Everything on the site is $3. That's what I got.
I am so not ready right now. I have a really good.
Oh, I can
good...
go on, but I know.
No, we're running out of time.
Here.
I have a really. Okay. I had a really good one.
Okay.
And I'm just shocked, actually, that you didn't have the same one. But I'm ready now, and here it is. Pantone announced their color of 2019. Pantone is a color institute. You know, designers know, and a lot of people know that they just deal with color. So the color is coral. Living coral, yeah. Not just any coral. Yeah. You're like, yeah, I already know this.
Well, no, I saw that swatch, which, anyway.
I got to go. We're running out of time. But thanks, everyone, for being here. Coral, let me just say, can I just say a word about coral? Because I don't see anyone pushing me off the air right now. This is what they say. It's a glorious yet unfortunately more elusive display beneath the sea. This vivifying and effervescent color mesmerizes the eye and mind. That's what I have to say. Oh, and right, also...
Sure.
It's affirming coral hue with a golden undertone that energizes and enlivens with a softer edge. So I went on way too long, Nance, with that. But I just want to say thank you to all of our guests. Thanks for being here. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. This is Apropos of Something. We'll see you next week. And thank you, Nance.
Okay.
Thanks, guests, for being here. This music is by Springtide.